say again, thank you for hanging in there until the end of the conference. I appreciate having more people in the audience than on the panel. That's just great. Okay, my talk is going to be about men. So the title of the talk is Social Networks Influence on HIV Testing Among Young Men in Tanzania. My name is Nina Yamanis, and I do this work in collaboration with colleagues at American University, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and also Muhimbili University of Health and Allied Sciences in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. So HIV testing among men in sub-Saharan Africa, men have very low rates of HIV testing. In several countries across sub-Saharan Africa, 30 to 50%. And the consequences to men are they premature mortality because of delayed engagement in ART, and then ongoing HIV transmission to women. Men's testing has also been linked to the success of HIV prevention interventions with women, such as PMTCT, so that when men engage in testing, women are also more likely to engage in testing. There's been several studies, mostly qualitative, on factors associated with men's testing in sub-Saharan Africa. And they show that there are two different categories of factors. Barriers include fear of testing, stigma, belief that health facilities are female spaces, norms associated with masculinity, and not wanting friends to see them at the clinic. Facilitators include fulfilling family obligations and peers getting tested. Recently, there was a systematic review in sub-Saharan Africa on HIV testing interventions for men, and they found that few interventions target men specifically. They also suggested that reaching men in community-based settings or social settings, rather than through clinics, which may be perceived as more female, or work sites, may be more effective for men. And then, as has been mentioned by Dr. Wexberg, the UNAIDS 2020 target requires that we scale up HIV testing for men so that 90% of men can know their status. So in the interest of thinking about how men can be reached through social settings or community-based settings, this study focuses on social networks and men. So we know from a rich sociological literature that social networks are naturally occurring sources of influence. And several studies, mostly outside of sub-Saharan Africa, have shown that peer behavior and norms influence men's risk behaviors, including inconsistent condom use, early sexual debut, number of sexual partners, and concurrency, which we showed in Dar es Salaam. We also know from sociology that there are a couple different ways networks can influence behavior. One is through network structure, and that may influence behavior through flow of information. And also network composition may influence behavior by shaping norms. And I'll give you some examples later in the presentation of what I mean by those two things in this study. This study's purpose was to therefore understand how social network structure, composition, and norms are associated with HIV testing among young men in Tanzania. And then also building on a recent systematic review of social network studies that showed a dearth of social network studies in sub-Saharan Africa, we wanted to fill that research gap as well. So the study is situated in Tanzania, where there's a 5% HIV prevalence rate, and 60% of new infections are among young people. Where we work in Dar es Salaam, which is the largest city in Tanzania, HIV prevalence is 6.9%, which is one of the highest rates in the country. And we know from the recent demographic and health survey that 47% of men aged 15 to 49 had ever tested for HIV, but that proportion was lower for younger men, so 34.2% of men aged 15 to 24 had ever tested. The social networks we're studying here are called CAMPS, and we've done some extensive formative research on CAMPS. CAMPS are naturally occurring social networks of mostly men. They do include some women, and I kind of think about them as a cross between a club and a gang. So young men kind of form their own camp, and they give their camp a name, an identity. A lot of these names have to do with like bragging kinds of things, like mafioso means ingenious boys, nyangumi camp means whale. So a lot of it is around masculinity and kind of projecting a masculine norm. But the interesting thing about them is that men in Dar es Salaam are very loyal to their camps. So the camps that we've understood have existed for an average of 8 years. They have an elected leadership, including a treasurer, a secretary, a chairman. They pay dues to their camp, and we've shown that they actually provide social support to the men for things like burials, for dealing with family crises, and they also kind of facilitate risk behavior. So they have parties at the camp, they meet sex workers at the camps, and they sometimes do include girlfriends of members. They also socialize in fixed locations, so a camp kind of claims a space geographically in kind of a slum area, and that can be a space that's either bounded by a physical structure or it can be open next to a tree, as in this case. So after this formative research, we've then initiated a cluster randomized controlled intervention trial with men in camps. The endpoints of this study are STI incidence and perpetration of intimate partner violence, and it's funded by NIMH. So in the first phase, we enumerated 300 camps across four wards of Dar es Salaam. We then selected 60 camps, 30 went to intervention, 30 to control, which included 1,249 men at baseline. This trial is ongoing, and today I'm going to present baseline data. We had ethical approvals from two IRBs, one at Muhimbili, one at UNC, and the eligibility for being in our two-year intervention was being 15 years or older, being a camp member for more than 3 months, visiting the camp more than one time per week, and residing in Dar es Salaam for the next 30 months. The baseline behavioral assessment took place in 2013 to 2014, and we did them on tablets with a computer-assisted personal interview, and the dependent variable in this case is have you ever had an HIV test? Our demographic and control variables include age, ever married, had at least one child, highest level of schooling completed, currently a student, and the time that camp members spend in the camp. So the social network data we got from actually giving each camp member a roster of all the members of their camp, and that roster included their first name, each camp member's first name, last name, age, nickname, because a lot of them have nicknames that, like AKAs, that they may be more known by, and gender. And each name was read aloud by the interviewer, and then the respondent was asked, do you know this person? And then for each person who was known, we asked, is this person a friend, an acquaintance, or someone you don't get along with? And in this study, we're looking at just friends. We also had an issue because we had some non-respondents in our study, and in social network analysis, missing data can be kind of an issue, so it can have a negative effect on the estimation of network properties. So we did a review and decided to exclude all networks in which non-respondents were more than 40% of camp members. We also used some imputation methods for the remaining camps. So 12 were excluded out of the 60 networks, and then two imputation methods were used for the remaining networks. So the next network structure variable we're looking at in this study is called core. Core is a subgroup in which actors are maximally connected. So if you think about a social network, let's say any network that you're part of, if you're part of a reading group, or there might be some people who are very central to that network. They get together all the time. They spread information among them, and then there are others who are more peripheral to the network. They might be the ones who are on the outside, they don't come as often, they don't share as much information. So this is an extension of Freeman's simple star. So you can see in this graph of nine network members that number 1, 9, 7, and 8 are kind of in the core. And the lines depict the relationships between people, and the numbers depict the people. So we used UCINET, which is a social network analysis software, to identify core, and UCINET kind of finds a partition where the correlation between the data and the ideal core periphery structure is maximized. We use core also because it's less sensitive to imputation. We had to use some imputation methods for our missing data, but the variable, in essence, is whether you're in the core or not. We also thought about network composition and what variable might be interesting in this context. So we hypothesized that camps with more women members might be more gender equitable, and that these gender equitable camps might have more gender equitable norms, and therefore that because gender equality is associated with HIV testing, men might test in those camps. So we included a variable proportion of women in the camp. Like other studies, we've included a measure of stigma. In this case, we relate it to the camp specifically. So this was based on a study from Uganda that did this in a community. In your camp, how many people think people with HIV have brought shame on their families or would avoid visiting the homes of people with HIV or think that if you have HIV, you have done wrong behaviors? And so they indicated how many people in their camp thought this way, and then we aggregated the responses, included the total as a variable in our analysis. From the list of friends, the participants were also asked to identify who are your two closest friends in the camp. And then for each of those closest friends, we asked them, has that friend encouraged you to have an HIV test? And then our variable was, has at least one of your two closest friends encouraged you to test? Our data analysis, again, was about, included just camps where less than 40% of the camp members were missing data, and we only included sexually active men, thinking that they were probably more likely to have had it or be interested in an HIV test. We used random effects logistic regression, and we did robustness checks with and without the imputed ties to make sure that the imputations weren't causing problems in the analysis, and we used data version 13. So these are descriptive statistics for 925 men, excluding those who were in camps that had more than 40% missing, excluding the sexually inactive men. That's how we got to 925. So you can see that 52% had HIV tested ever. The mean age was about 27. 27% were ever married. 39% had at least one child. 9% were currently a student. And the levels of education completed were pretty low. Form 4 is like the highest level of high school. Only 22% had completed Form 4. And then they said that 89% said that their fellow camp members very often or often spend time in the camp. 37% were in the network core. 15% was the average proportion of women in the camp, but it ranged from 0 to 67%. The mean HIV stigma score was 2.43, and 48% said at least one close friend had encouraged them to test. These are our results. So in terms of demographic and education completed, we see that age was associated with ever HIV testing. Having children was associated with ever HIV testing, which I think is interesting for men, given that they probably had to test with the mothers of their children, perhaps. Having more education was more associated with testing. So in all the talk about women being in school, I also think, well, men also need to stay in school. And then being in the network core was associated with increased odds of testing, as was the proportion of women in the camp. HIV stigma, like others have shown, was our only negative effect. So more stigma in the camp was associated with less testing. And having at least one close friend who encouraged you to test meant you had a 2 times higher likelihood of ever testing. These are some pictorial graphs of our results. So blue means having tested for HIV, and red is not having tested. And this was one camp network in which we had no missing data. The solid lines indicated that a friend had ever encouraged them to test. And you can see here, in the core, there was actually an 80% HIV testing rate. And then in the periphery, there was a 55% testing rate. This was a graph where you can see we had more missing data, which are the double triangles are missing data. Here, we had 67% of those in the core had tested, and 53% of those in the periphery had tested. So in sum, we found that network factors are associated with testing for men. Men in the network core were more likely to test, so this suggests that core network members may actually serve as gatekeepers of information with regarding to testing. They may also, in terms of interventions, allow information to flow more quickly through networks. So it suggests perhaps by targeting core network members, we would be able to spread behavior change more quickly. Also, the men in camps with greater proportion of women were more likely to test. Women in general were more likely to test in our sample, so we had a smaller sample of women. Only 242 women were in those camps, but 76% of the women tested. So given that those women are testing, they may just contribute to the camp norm for testing. Or those camps may be more gender equitable because they include women, so men in those camps may also have more positive views towards women therefore may be more likely to test. We found, similar to other studies, that friends' encouragement of testing was significant for men to test. And this has been shown qualitatively, but we're some of the first to show it quantitatively. We also found that there was a negative effect for stigma norms on HIV testing, which has also been previously reported. So in terms of intervention implications, we think that social networks are naturally occurring sources of influence for men in this setting, and that we should target them in order to increase men's rates of testing. Also, we can target specific network members to try to diffuse information more quickly, and we're doing that in the ongoing trial, so we'll have results on that to come. And changing social norms related to stigma and gender equity would have positive influences on HIV testing for men. And finally, encouraging men to test with a friend may be a promising strategy for increasing testing. Thank you, and here are my references.
So we want to thank our presenters for today, and we also want to thank you who attended. This means so much, especially being the last day. So now we move into the session for questions, and you're free to ask any one of the presenters whatever questions you may have jotted down as they were presenting. And even if you have a comment to make, that's welcome. The sessions are being recorded, so I request the presenters to repeat the question so that it's recorded along the answer. So if you can just repeat your question.
I think you asked about what is community helper, right? At the pilot study in the Kenya, we have the community visitor. So when we also for the other one study, in the Zimbabwe study, we have the helper, school-based helper. And then in the other one study, we have the research nurse staff, because this is the trial for the make them orphans stay in school. We want to check whether what's the problem if they miss the school. That's how they may have a monthly visit or weekly visit to the study participant and check whether they are in school or if they miss the what is the reason for that. It's for sickness or any other abuse problem in the family. That's what I want to find out. That's why we have the community helpers and school-based the helper or the research nurse staff. Yeah, actually we started from the 26 primary schools. I think that's all co-ed primary schools. But when they transition to secondary school, there are some boys boarding school or some girls boarding school, and they can go anywhere. So because we just finished our preliminary analysis now, because we just got the HSB result last month. So we are working on the more additional analysis. And then also I found that there are a lot of difference by schools. In terms of sexual debut, maybe gender composition or some network, and it's going to significantly predict for the sexual behavior. So I'm going to work on it. Thank you. Yeah, the reason why we test for the HSV2 is that because it's the HIV prevention trial, and the HSV2 is the predictor for the HSV infection. Also, we believe the HSV2 infection is the kind of indicator of sexual debut. That's why we include this when it's HSV2 infection.
Necessarily officially considered on the HIV test measures, but That's a good question. So your question is, how did we identify whether they were sex workers or not? And so it's in the screener of whether they're trading for, and it's not just money, but it's goods, services, and their survival.
More questions?
I have a question for almost all of you, the presenters. The first one is to Grace. I know you said the health providers would not disclose apparent HIV serostatus without their permission, and it's also sometimes very difficult for some parents. Did you encounter any situation whereby the health providers are forced to disclose because the parents are not anywhere near disclosing for the sake of the family?
I actually did not. They tend to avoid that. They would rather prefer to cancel the parents. They do have issues where, you know, like parents, they make the plan and they say, the one parent might say, I will not disclose until I speak to my husband, or I have to go home and speak to my wife. And then they say, come back and tell us. And then when they come back, they avoid the healthcare providers or somebody else, and aunties come in to bring the child. So you don't want to bring additional conflict, so they avoid that. It's basically the parents' consent is what goes. I did not see that they wanted to do that.
More questions as we go on? The second question is to Sam. I know you are basically focusing on supporting these children through education. The recent interventions in HIV/AIDS which are mainly effective are those which we call integrated and coordinated. In other words, you don't just focus on one thing. Because these children, when they come from school, they go home. How do you liaise with the home situation to make sure that it's not just the educational needs that are being met, but these children are also receiving the other needs they need so that you can actually reduce the risks?
I'm not sure I understand your question correctly. But my hypothesis is that if we help orphans stay in school, they are more likely attached to a pro-social environment, pro-social structure, and pro-social teachers. And they're going to have a change in their attitude about their future expectation, educational aspiration, and then also the attitude about early sexual debut, which results in the proximate outcome of the marriage and the condom use and the pregnancy. That's what we expected to result in less positive HIV infection, HSV infection. Can I add?
Yeah, so that's a little bit of the question. When they come from school, they go back home, and if they're struggling with issues at home, for example, nutrition, maybe the home environment is not supportive, how do you liaise with the families just apart from giving education needs?
Yeah, if they stay in boarding school, they can eat, and that's a good thing. And there's no control in outside of school environment, actually. But actually, when we pay the school fee to the family member household, they can have some extra money for their saving because they don't need to pay school fee. So I think that really helps the orphan the groups.
Was the money paid directly to school, or was the money paid directly to the family members? Because a lot of times you find that these orphans, the money does not even, you know, help them directly. A lot of people, due to corruption, they pocket the money. So how did you guys, you know, make sure that their school was paid for? They got all the needs, as my sister is saying there, they got food and everything else.
Yeah, that is a really good question, and because when we pay school fee, we have to make sure that students receive school fee. And so we have this research staff at the Moin University, the accountant. We have an accountant. We go to the visit the school and check the study participant, and we wired money from the school directory. So the parents and students can get the receipt, and teacher can get the receipt from us, but we always make sure that students are in school.
Yeah, so the question was that in Nigeria it's required for women who are pregnant to bring their partner in to donate blood. I don't actually know the answer to the question. I mean, there's a lot of different ANC clinics around Dar, and they're run by different organizations, so they may have different protocols with respect to that. But I also know that some of these men are having children without being necessarily married, so I don't know if that would be a requirement if it's a non-marital partner. Yeah.
Well, having working with HIV positive, I just wanted to add something on top. I've realized that the research you guys are doing in Kenya, it's not much different in Kenya and other parts of Africa, like Tanzania. It's actually not much different to here, because Grace talked about the disclosure. We are having an issue, and at least here in America, we are protected by HIPAA and confidentiality. So we're still seeing that more and more. Like, I have a caseload, and I have patients that some of their partners don't even know that they are HIV positive. We've been trying to work with them, for the disclosure part of it, so that if the partners are safe, they can also come and receive the treatment. But it's a problem, and that is something that, personally, coming from Kenya, is an ethical dilemma, because you see it happening, and you don't know how you can intervene. Just because I work for the hospital and you can't. So I don't know if you guys have any suggestions for.
I've been to Dar es Salaam, but I can speak from South Africa, working in a couple study and doing testing. Is that was our own dilemma as well. It was 2-1, by the way. And these were not sex workers. These were women who the men were identified as alcohol drinkers. We identified them in Shebeens. And 26% of the women were HIV positive. 13% of the men were found positive, but they did not want. And they had been partners at least a year. They did not want to disclose to each other. And though they were in an intervention and we wanted to talk about that, they were fearful of blame, stigma, more intimate partner violence, and the dependency in the relationship of who had other partners, even though they'd been in this partnership, of where HIV came from. So I would tell you, I don't have an answer for that, but it is a dilemma, and yet, as far as for ethical reasons, we want to maintain confidentiality. And I do want to say to you, in working with the health departments as well, our own community advisory board, who have higher level health department people, said, do the testing yourself, because there lacks confidentiality. And some people actually go to other villages or other health departments because too many people gossip. And then there's no protection and there's more stigma. So I guess you're all nodding to say, yeah, this is a real problem. And I worry about that.
I saw a hand over there.
I can add on to that. I have published a lot of papers. I have 4 and 1 in peer review right now. Mostly it's parents to children. So if you have that as an issue, you can read the papers. They're accessible through my LinkedIn profile. I'm also looking for papers for call for abstracts to increase more knowledge on HIV-affected families. So anybody you know, if you can pass the word out, it's on Frontiers Journal. And if we publish 5 papers, we'll get a book published out of it. But it's all aspects, men who have sex with men, any relationship within a family, so partners, children, parents to children. So, but you can get my first article on PAJ. It has a lot of tips on how to proceed with the process. But it's a gray area. It's challenging. Even my last quote, if you go and read it on the presentation, it's a peer reviewer, educator. He has talked about it with his wife. His wife, he educates people, he helps people to disclose, but his wife is not willing to disclose. They've gone for counseling, so they've not disclosed to their children. They haven't even tested the 2 oldest children, and he's a peer educator working with people who are HIV positive. So it's a very, very gray area, and I don't know how we're going to help and improve disclosure status across the world.
You had your hand?
Yeah, I just want to offer is that I don't know what's in time here, but the PMPCP clinic in Zambia
Then this question is to Westbrook. I know your work is in South Africa, and you're focusing on mainly sex workers and non-sex workers. But this question relates to what we find when we are doing research out there. Sometimes you find some very interesting things that may not have been part of your research. We have heard of virgin rapes in South Africa. Do you have any comment on that? Because I imagine if some of these women have children, some of their partners are likely to rape these children.
So you said virginal rapes, is that it?
Virgin rapes.
Yeah.
They rape the virgins.
So when I started in South Africa, the myth of you'll get rid of HIV or AIDS if you rape a virgin was the myth, actually, just not in South Africa. It's been in a lot of countries. And it seemed that there were horrible rapings of babies. And there was one case I followed where the baby was less than two and I forgot, there was a baby that was 9 months old, and there were a couple of dozen operations of this child being put back together. So there are some horrible situations, but I can tell you, when you think of, one, these very bad myths, and part of our intervention is also to dispel myths in our men's intervention, our women's intervention, our couples intervention, dispel myths about abuse, dispel myths about HIV. But part of the problem is also close quarters. So, you know, when people are living in shacks and then they have the windy houses outside and you have an uncle who's living with you and comes home drunk. Or methamphetamine, and I hate to bring this up, but since I work in addiction, I'll share with you. So methamphetamine is an upper. And what does an upper do to your body but also make men very horny and have a very stiff dick? And so when they come home, women have said to us, he will want to have sex with me and I don't want to have sex with him, but I'd rather him have sex with me than have sex with my children. And men are known to have sex with the animals as well. So there's an interaction. If we talk about what's happening, is there's alcohol, there's drug use, and some of these men are out of their mind, and they'd also know what to do with their stiff member. So methamphetamine is a major, major problem, especially in the Western Cape, and it's made with battery acid and a lot of garbage. The young women I'm working with, by the way, that have dropped out of school, we have another project that we're working on. It really melts your brains. If you talk about cognitive deficits, we have a problem, and they're also having babies, and they're involved in gangs, and they're being gang raped. So there are problems. Back to your question, yes, there is a myth. We're trying to dispel that. I haven't heard it in a while. But because of these other things people are doing, they act inhumanely.
One last question. One last comment.
Sorry to leave it with that. Let's thank everybody for the work we do. We have to keep doing it and not give up, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, let's do the last.